From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Callum Borchers in Boston. It's Here and Now. Many of us have only known about the Omicron coronavirus variant for a few days, but governments are responding quickly to this new and threatening development. The U.S. and other countries have issued travel bans, and there could be more U.S. travel restrictions soon. Here and Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan is here to talk about what it all means for holiday plans. Seth, could you bring us up to speed on the status quo for starters? What are the current restrictions here in the U.S.?
Well, domestic, there really aren't any restrictions besides wear a mask and, well, don't fight with flight attendants, right? What changed for international travel as of just a few weeks ago is that the rules became much more liberal. U.S. citizens need only proof of vaccination or a recent negative COVID-19 test. Non-citizens can travel from anywhere in the world. They need both, though. They need proof of vaccination as well as a recent COVID-19 test. What changed just in recent days is the big exception to that, countries from Southern Africa, like South Africa and Botswana. Non-citizens now severely restricted from traveling to the U.S.
I see. And what do we know about what's to come? We're hearing that there could be more restrictions on the table.
Almost certainly something, and we don't know is exactly what yet. First, the testing window. Right now, I said recent COVID-19 test just before, right? What does recent mean? Right now, it means within the past 3 days. It can be either a PCR test or a rapid test. Those rapid tests, of course, the benefit is that they're faster, although they're not always quite as accurate. That could be shortened to as recent to just 1 day, for example. And then we'll have to see if any other restrictions come about. Those restrictions, by the way, on countries in Southern Africa, the World Health Organization and others have criticized them and basically said that South Africa is being punished for coming forward with that information about Omicron. And of course, there's always lag time between when infections occur and when we know about them. It's becoming clear that Omicron is in many other parts of the world already.
Yeah, well, and to that point, I mean, some listeners, Seth, may be flashing back to travelers getting stranded overseas in the early days of the pandemic. Should travelers now be concerned about going somewhere on vacation this holiday season and then being unable to get back home?
Well, U.S. citizens are almost certainly always going to be allowed to return to the U.S. What happened early in the pandemic is that airlines canceled so many flights so quickly that even if you were allowed to go somewhere, getting there logistically wasn't always feasible. That's less likely to happen this time. I mean, we saw what happened with the Delta variant. Travel bookings certainly dropped off and airlines reacted to that, but it wasn't nearly like it was at the onset of the pandemic. And this is, of course, all just emerging here. We all learned about Omicron just in recent days, but that's the more likely case here, is that this will be a problem for airlines and for some travelers, yes, but in terms of a U.S. citizen being able to get back home, probably less of a threat now than it was early in the pandemic.
Yeah, as you said, those bookings started to drop with the emergence of Delta. What's the early evidence for Omicron? Are people canceling their travel plans right now?
I reached out to a firm called Forward Keys, which often has an early read on booking data, and they told me that it's just still too early to have enough of a sample size to say what's happening with this or to compare it. I asked them this to Delta variant. Are people more or less concerned about this? But they said, look, the history is that whenever news like this comes out, people do, to some degree or another, book less travel than previously. And I could tell you, if you look at the financial markets, on a broad stock market rally today, midday trading, American Airlines, Delta, and United all down, not participating in the market rally. Southwest Airlines, the fourth of the major U.S. airlines, up a bit. And that tells you people are more concerned about those global airlines that fly around the world than they are about an airline that serves almost all domestic travelers.
Sure. And the fear may be that whether it's Omicron or some other variant, that this kind of, you know, stop and go pattern could be what we're in for a while. And that kind of uncertainty sometimes spooks investors. That's Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Thanks for the time, as always.
Thanks, Callum.
And those travel restrictions are infuriating leaders across Southern Africa, and that's where we're going to head next. Experts predict a surge in new cases in the coming days and weeks across the region. Dr. Michael Adekunle-Charles is with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Southern Africa. He's in Pretoria. Dr. Charles, good to speak with you.
Thank you very much, and good morning, good afternoon to the listeners.
Yeah, the world is closely watching what's happening there in Southern Africa. Are you able to make a connection between the rise in cases across the region and the Omicron variant?
Well, the rise in cases across the region is expected. The scientists have said that we will be going into a, you know, sort of a fourth wave in December, and this is happening. So with or without the Omicron variant, we knew that cases would rise. But first and foremost, I think for me, it is really important as an organization to really thank the South African scientists for bringing this to the world, you know, to thank their good efforts in terms of genome sequencing, and to thank them in terms of really ensuring that the world knows what is happening with this COVID variant. Mm. So the Omicron is here with us, but it's also here with many other countries.
Let's talk about vaccines. In South Africa, about 35% of the population is fully vaccinated. But we're also hearing that some governments are turning away new shipments of vaccines because they can't use what they already have. What are the obstacles that you're seeing to getting people vaccinated?
Well, obviously, with vaccine, we will have some, you know, people that are a bit vaccine hesitant. In the urban areas, we're seeing less of this. It's more in the rural areas. And that's why our volunteers are on the ground and trying to work both at the community level, but also with the health services to ensure that, you know, people take the vaccines. The last thing we want is that the vaccines to expire. And that's why, you know, there's reports that some shipments have been taken to other African countries. So it's not that we have too many vaccines. It's just that we're trying to ensure that there's enough vaccine equity on the continent and no vaccine goes to waste.
When experts say that this variant, Omicron, might not have had the chance to emerge if rich countries hadn't hoarded vaccines and then left poorer countries exposed, what do you say to that?
So the vaccines are somewhat there, but they're not enough. What we're saying, and you can see it in Europe as well, whereby there is a fraction of the population that are hesitant with vaccines. So I think it's really working with timelines to say, do we continue working in terms of getting, you know, jabs in people's arms when we know that there's a hesitancy and then there's the risk that those vaccines will, you know, go to waste? Or do we take them to other countries where they can get into people's arms while we are waiting to get fresher vaccines into the country? So I think that's the paradox that we're living with. But from a country perspective, the government is actually wanting to make it mandatory for people to get vaccinated so that the vaccine uptake can increase dramatically. And we're saying that if we are able to increase it, if we're able to have herd immunity, the likelihood of variants in future would be less.
I want to ask you about the feeling on the ground there in Southern Africa. Here's South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa speaking recently about the travel restrictions imposed on the region.
The prohibition of travel is not informed by science, nor will it be effective in preventing the spread of this variant. The only thing the prohibition on travel will do is to further damage the economies of the affected countries and undermine their ability to respond to and also to recover from the pandemic.
Do you share the opinion of the South African president? I mean, are the travel restrictions hindering your ability to do your work?
Definitely, it's hindering our ability to do the work. I was meant to travel within the sub-region just over the weekend, but I couldn't because of the travel restrictions. The travel restrictions, in the eyes of many South Africans, is really unfair. South Africans cannot be punished for genome sequencing. And I think since the travel bans, it has come to light that even this variant had been in Europe even before South Africa announced it. There's very little travel restrictions in Europe. Why should there be travel restrictions on the continent, specifically in Southern Africa?
Mm. I'm speaking to you on December 1st, World AIDS Day. From your vantage point in South Africa, how are you reflecting on that, especially, of course, as we're still in the grips of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yes, it's actually a sad day for us, World AIDS Day, because South Africa or Southern Africa has been the epicenter of HIV/AIDS, and we are all reflecting in terms of the people that have died, the people that we've lost, but more importantly, reflecting on the children that are left behind. In Southern Africa, there are a lot of orphans and vulnerable children. And with the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, we're really trying to support them in the communities. So today's a day of reflection, but it's also a day to be thankful thankful to the science, thankful to the treatments that we have now. And so, you know, in all this grief, in all the things that we've lost, we also need to be thankful to the scientists. And it is this same scientist that have been able to sequence the genome or the variant when it comes to COVID-19. So all the investments that has been made in the past in terms of science in Southern Africa and in South Africa specifically has really gone to show that indeed, you know, South Africa can be the champions when it comes to science. And, you know, we've been able to show that in this discovery of the variant.
Dr. Michael Adekunle Charles is with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Southern Africa. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. Have a good day.
And on this World AIDS Day, a story about those who took risks in a time of great need. In the 1980s and 90s, many AIDS activists believed the Catholic Church turned its back on people dying of the disease. At this protest in 1989, gay New Yorkers were furious that Archbishop John O'Connor refused to acknowledge that condoms could help slow down the epidemic. At the same time, many devout Catholics and clergy reached out and even ministered to sick young men who were shunned by the institution of the church. Michael O'Loughlin tells these stories in a new book called Hidden Mercy, which caused him to reflect on his own life as well. Michael, welcome.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So right at the beginning of the book, you write, "I am gay and I am Catholic." What was it like to even put those words on paper?
It wasn't easy. Even though I'm comfortably gay and comfortably Catholic, I still have a hard time kind of talking about that. And then to set out to write an entire book with a premise sort of covering those topics was a bit daunting, but ultimately I'm glad that I did that.
And many people will wonder how you can be comfortably gay and comfortably Catholic, and I hope that's something we can kind of come to understand a little bit better through this conversation. Tell me about that struggle to reconcile those two parts of your identity and how it led to the book. And to also to the Catholic priests and the nuns who really put everything out on the line during the AIDS crisis in the 1980s and 90s.
For the past decade or so, I've been reporting on Catholicism and sort of its role in the public square. And when I started off reporting, a lot of that conversation was about same-sex marriage because you had a lot of Catholic leaders who were fighting against same-sex marriage laws in various states around the country. And I was tasked with covering that for different publications where I wrote. And it was somewhat of a personal journey, too, because though I wasn't publicly out, I am gay and I was Catholic covering this seemingly hostile development in terms of church leaders and same-sex marriage. And I just felt like this was all new, that I was learning about this clash for the first time. And I didn't really know where to turn. I didn't have people to talk to ask, how did you make it work being a gay Catholic? And it was over dinner one evening with a priest friend who's a bit older than me, and he had worked in HIV and AIDS ministry back in the 90s, and he was telling me about some of his experiences. And I had always known that there was this history of the Vatican cracking down on gay Catholics in the 1980s, but I hadn't considered that that was all happening against the backdrop of HIV and AIDS. And my friend was telling me that there was a lot there and encouraged me to explore that because there was this time where there was this very intense clash between the gay community and the Catholic Church.
Let's dig into some of those stories. You profile a nun named Sister Carol. She was from a small town in Illinois. She went to New York City to learn how to care for people who were dying with AIDS. Tell us more about Sister Carol and really what motivated her to do that.
Sister Carol Baltashevitz was a Catholic nun who had worked in emergency rooms and ICUs in the Midwest, and she was kind of burnt out as she approached 40. And she decided to do something a bit easier, so she moved down to Belleville, a small city in southern Illinois, and began home care nursing. And pretty quickly, she encountered her first patient who had pretty advanced AIDS. And she grew really frustrated because she didn't know how to help. So she and another sister in her community, Mary Ellen Rombach, they approached their superior and said, "We need to move where HIV and AIDS is already a major crisis because it's going to become one here someday. And they packed their bags and moved to New York City for 6 months. She was immersing herself in the gay community, working at Catholic hospitals that had HIV and AIDS wards, volunteering on AIDS hotlines. And it was a lot for her because you had a small town nun really learning about gay life in New York in the 1980s. But she did that because she wanted to be able to move back home and serve people who were back in Belleville.
You profile at great length a priest named Father Bill McNichols who ministered to men who were dying of AIDS. And I want to play this tape. It's from 1987 at a protest. He's speaking with ABC News about why gay Catholics were so angry at church leaders.
I think it is the cruelest thing in the world to ask a human being never to be touched, never to be held, never to be treated like everyone else gets treated simply because they're born one way or another. They ask that of no other person.
How radical were people like Sister Carol and Father Bill? How far outside of the orthodoxy?
Sister Carol and Father Bill, especially in that tape, were quite radical in challenging the institutional church, which was really cracking down on the gay rights movement in the 1980s as HIV and AIDS was becoming a public health crisis. And Father Bill did so at great personal risk. He was a member of a religious order that had a lot of control over his public image. And he was encountering young gay men dying from AIDS and said, I need to take this risk to be a voice for them because they don't have a voice in the way that I do. And his ministry affected countless numbers of people because of his courage in talking about the things he believed in.
I noticed a significant difference, but you tell me if I'm right about this, between the institution of the Catholic Church and what the leaders were saying about the AIDS epidemic or about gay members in the Catholic community and what was actually happening at the local parish. Is that right?
It's true. It's a good observation. And something I try to do in the book is show that the institutional church was pretty hostile to the gay rights movement. At the same time, there are many, many people like Father Bill and Sister Carol who were doing the right things, who were setting up the clinics, visiting the hospital wards, fighting for rights in the public square. But they were doing so against an institutional bigotry that unfortunately still persists to this day.
There were quite a few instances of local parishes actually reaching out to the gay community. For instance, you tell the story of one church in Chicago that had an interfaith AIDS service that was attended by the winner of the International Mr. Leather contest. It kind of sounds like a joke, but actually it was serious and had some pretty profound effects. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there was a community of mostly men into leather who would hold a convention each year in Chicago. And in the 80s and 90s, they really pivoted to being advocates for HIV and AIDS awareness and fighting for gay civil rights. And there was this idea that they should get involved with the AIDS interfaith vigil walk, that they had something to contribute and they weren't going to sort of hide even though they weren't fully welcome or embraced in the gay community. So there's this scene in the late 80s where many of these leather men are gathered inside this Catholic church in Chicago, seated right up front. They're not willing to hide who they are. And they ultimately help lead this candlelight vigil through Boys Town in Chicago. And you had these different communities that seemed ripe for a clash, but ultimately found a way to make it work.
Oh, take us back to that time, the 80s and the 90s, and just, you know, why you think these people were able to connect. It was such a terrifying, uncertain time. What was driving these people?
It was literally a fight for their lives. I think it's hard for us to imagine what HIV and AIDS did to a generation of gay men. That fight for survival when everything else seems hopeless because you're being ignored or even stigmatized by institutions that should be protecting you, there was this commonality that we have to do something to work together to raise awareness.
I'm speaking with Michael O'Loughlin. He's author of the new book, Hidden Mercy. It's about the quiet work of Catholics during the AIDS epidemic. Michael, what happened when priests started getting sick and dying of AIDS? What kind of ripples did that set off inside the church?
It became clear even by the late 1980s that HIV and AIDS was having a pretty significant impact on the Catholic priesthood in the United States, which is a problem, of course, because Catholic priests are called to celibacy. Gay men officially are barred from being Catholic priests, even though there are many gay priests. And the reaction was interesting. On an institutional level, there was a lot of denial and even outright cover-up that priests were dying from AIDS. But again, on the more pastoral on the ground level, which is where I reported, there was a lot of examples of care and compassion from either bishops or religious superiors who saw in their friends and colleagues dying these terrible deaths, this need to be more compassionate in the public square. So in a way, you kind of got the best and the worst of the church's response in this phenomenon of priests dying from AIDS.
But how did people, maybe lay people within the church, perceive that? Because well, there was already a stigma around AIDS. It must have been even greater when, someone who was supposed to be celibate got sick.
There was, and I think that's why there was a lot of cover-up. But I write in the book about an example of a priest in Chicago who died from AIDS-related complications and insisted that at his funeral mass that the priest preaching the homily acknowledged how he died. And it was his attempt to sort of help lessen the stigma that if he could come out publicly with his own struggles with HIV and AIDS, it might encourage others to do so as well.
We talked a little bit at the beginning about your own struggle to reconcile your faith with your sexuality. How did the people who you met in your book try to answer that same question? Because, you know, I understand Father Bill was also gay.
Yeah, Father Bill was gay. I talked to gay priests. I talked to LGBT lay Catholics. And I asked them all this question, how do you stay in this institution that seems so unwelcoming? And there were a variety of answers. Some people say they ignore official church teaching and don't even listen to what the Vatican or what bishops say. Others say that they struggle with it, but they find a welcoming parish and make that work. They go to a church where there's a priest who welcomes all sorts of families. But ultimately, I think the thread through all the answers was you have to decide you want to be part of your faith community, whatever it is, and then be willing to do the hard work to make those spaces welcoming and not shrink back when you encounter resistance.
What about you? I kind of feel like maybe you were asking those questions of them as because you were trying to find the answer for yourself. How have you been able to stay in the Catholic Church? I mean, many of your peers have left long ago.
For me, it's a cultural thing. I grew up Catholic. My family's Catholic. But spiritually, it's where I feel most connected to God, where I feel like through the Eucharist, I'm connected to the divine, through the sacraments that my faith comes alive. And I haven't found that elsewhere. I know others have. I explored once joining a more welcoming Christian tradition, ultimately didn't follow through with it because I feel home in the Catholic Church, and I'm reluctant to let anyone tell me that I am not welcome in my home.
Michael O'Loughlin's new book is Hidden Mercy, AIDS, Catholics, and the Untold Stories of Compassion in the Face of Fear. Thank you very much for speaking with us about it. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
In Atlanta, the mayoral vote is in. Andre Dickens, an 8-year councilman, will succeed current mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. With Lance Bottoms' endorsement, Dickens catapulted ahead of the council president, Felicia Moore, and former mayor Kasim Reed in what pollsters are calling an upset victory. Here's Dickens in his victory speech last night.
I said before that my real opponents in this race was never one of those 13 opponents that we thought they were. My opponent is homelessness, hopelessness, joblessness, racism, poverty, violence. My opponent has been around for 50, 100, 2,000 years.
Stephen Fowler is here to tell us more about Dickens' election. He covers politics for member station Georgia Public Broadcasting. And Stephen, that's a long list of issues we just heard from Dickens, and other candidates pledged to confront the same problems. Several were better known than he was at the start of the race. So how did Dickens convince voters that he is the best person for the job?
Well, the two main candidates that people were looking at as current city council president Felicia Moore, who had long said she wanted to run for mayor, and former mayor of Atlanta Kasim Reed. There were a lot of people that have a lot of negative opinions about Reed, and so Moore and Dickens ended up being candidates for these anyone but Kasim Reed people. But Dickens has been around for a while as a city council member, so because there were so many people in the race, he ended up getting enough support that pushed him into the runoff ahead of Reed.
But despite being on the council for 8 years, Stephen, he wasn't as well known as some of these other candidates, as we mentioned. So tell us a bit more about his background.
Well, he's a lifelong Atlantan. He graduated from Georgia Tech, got a master's from Georgia State, was a church deacon, worked in Atlanta's booming tech industry, and he was city council member for 8 years. So he has been a fixture in the community. And he told one of my colleagues on election day yesterday that, you know, his campaign was getting seen and heard, and it just took more time for more people to see and hear he's the best one for Atlanta.
Stephen, tell us more about the demographics of Atlanta. We know it's a changing city. Where did Dickens draw his support from?
Well, Atlanta is a changing city, and in fact, the latest census numbers show that it's no longer a majority Black city. It's known as a bastion for Black political power, and that's seen in the election results where the typically African-American southern parts of the city supported Dickens. Now, his runoff opponent, Felicia Moore, is also Black. She got more support in the whiter, wealthier parts of North Atlanta, and the key difference this time is the east side of Atlanta, where a lot of the growth and diversity and, frankly, gentrification is happening, and they rallied around Dickens as well to provide this commanding victory.
Well, and Stephen, you're hinting at one of the first challenges that the new mayor is going to run into when he steps into office, which is that there's a secession crisis from a wealthy white enclave of Atlanta called Buckhead. What's going on there?
So there is a movement mainly spearheaded by Republicans who don't live in the city of Atlanta or this community to get this neighborhood of Buckhead to become its own city. It's an unprecedented action because to create this city, it would have to take away a good chunk of the tax revenue and population from the city of Atlanta. And there's a lot of opposition to this. There's a bill that's working its way through Georgia's legislature that would allow voters in that neighborhood to vote on their new cityhood. But it's a huge challenge that has repercussions far beyond, you know, who wins or loses in the votes, because it's a big part of Atlanta's fabric. It's a big part of Atlanta's school and tax base. And so that's the number one thing he's going to have to deal with.
Stephen Fowler, politics reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Solar power provided less than 4% of the country's electricity last year, but President Biden wants it to be nearly 50% by 2050. Ivan Penn is a Los Angeles-based energy correspondent for the New York Times. Ivan, welcome, and what would it take to reach the president's goal?
Well, there are quite a few hurdles, and in the past, it was a technological one. Solar wasn't quite there a couple of decades ago, but technologically, you know, it's proven to be a workable source of generation. So our issues now have more to do with policy. You have the fossil fuel industry that argues we're not at a place where solar can be a dominant source of energy because obviously it only produces when the sun is shining. So it needs something to support it. Batteries would be one way, the fossil fuel industry says, well, we need the bridge fuel of natural gas to get to this clean energy future where sources like solar can play this significant role.
Let's take a moment to talk about those batteries that you just referenced. How much progress have we seen with the battery technology so that we can store that energy when the sun is shining and use it when it's not?
Well, we've made significant progress technologically and economically, but we still have a bit of a ways to go. Part of the challenge is in the makeup of the batteries. So the technology of choice has been lithium-ion batteries. Part of the cost issue there and the technological issue is, you know, obviously lithium is a primary component, and it's largely sourced in South America and Australia and processed in China. So all of those components to producing the batteries, you know, that's a lot of cost. And what we're trying to do in the United States is to see about domestically sourced lithium and a reduction of some of the other elements in lithium ion batteries, particularly cobalt, which largely comes from places like the Congo in Africa. So if we can provide a domestic source, that should help with cost and also help with domestic industry.
Might also be controversial because, of course, mining lithium in our own backyard could come along with some environmental issues. Now, listen, I live in a very sunny state of Arizona, where I've noticed that many more rooftop solar installations have gone up. There are still federal tax credits to cover 30% of the cost. What role do you think individual homes will play in a renewable future for solar, as opposed to, say, a utility-scale project that's out in the desert somewhere?
Well, you know, and I mentioned the tension, and even within, under the solar umbrella, if you will, there's tension between the utility scale and the rooftop solar. Clean energy proponents would rather there not be this kind of tension, but the reality is that there is. And one of the parts of this is the utility scale. Obviously, panels are cheaper because it's a large number of panels for a solar farm. On the rooftop side of things, you're talking about the ability of homeowners to take more control of their electricity. Couple that with a home battery and an electric vehicle, especially where electric vehicle technology is going to not only consume energy, but the car itself to be able to help power your home along with the stationary battery that might be in your home. Solar energizing those batteries, powering those batteries, it really changes a lot of dynamics for the lives of the individual. Where some of the additional tension comes in is, you know, overall, solar, it's a different kind of job market that it creates, where you might have, I mean, in both cases of big box power plants like a natural gas plant and a solar farm or rooftop solar, obviously, you've got the construction installation jobs. But after that's done, fossil fuel plants like natural gas, you know, that's dozens of jobs to maintain and operate. A solar farm, you know, it's perhaps someone who cleans the panels. Rooftop solar, you know, those jobs disappear. So there's the tension over labor. There's the tension over cost. There's the tension of the impact that this has on utilities if everybody's producing their own. And storing their own.
I'm starting to understand why the utilities might be concerned that they may not be able to sell my neighbor or me or the whole entire city power if everyone's getting the energy from the panels on top of their roofs. Have those questions largely been settled, or are they brewing out in the future still?
This has not been settled, and you see even today a great deal of this debate from Florida to California. Part of that debate is how much should a homeowner who has solar be compensated for the excess power that they generate and deliver to the electric grid?
That's called net metering, correct?
That's right. And in many cases, the net metering policies compensate the homeowner the equivalent of a retail dollar for dollar compensation. And the utilities say, well, that's not fair because we can get that electricity cheaper on the wholesale market. And so this is putting an undue burden on those who don't have solar. And especially their argument is the poor and the low income.
Well, then let's talk about equity, because solar is great if you can afford your own home, if you can afford to put the panels on your roof. But what about everybody else? Is there an effort out there to make solar more equitable?
There are efforts to do that. The argument that solar hurts the poor, the low income, and even, you know, middle class is overly simplistic. The other side of the argument is that there are projects that show how the average person who's not even a homeowner can benefit from rooftop solar and a battery. Biggest example is in Utah, a new apartment complex where there's solar panels, and in every apartment unit, there's a battery. The benefit of all of this is that not only does the individual renter actually have their own battery that can keep their home powered even if the grid goes down, there is the technological ability to harness all of the batteries in that complex and send that power to the electric grid to support the grid. And they call it a battery swarm. And, you know, that's an enormous benefit that no matter whether you're a renter or not, you know, you're able to participate in that.
It sounds like there's a lot of unanswered questions in the future, a lot of fights with utilities, legal questions, that sort of thing. What's your prediction for the solar industry over the next decade or so? Do you think it will become as prominent as the federal government wants it to be right now?
Well, the biggest thing is that solar is one of the least expensive generation sources now. The price of solar is really, really cheap, especially in comparison to fossil fuel generators now. So that's going to be a big driver. There is the push for the continuation of federal tax credits in support of solar and for batteries. So, you know, I mean, there's a great deal of potential for a revolutionary way of looking at our energy picture that the electric grid didn't contemplate when we built it 100 years ago.
Ivan Penn is a Los Angeles-based energy correspondent for The New York Times, talking to us today about solar energy and its future here in the United States. Ivan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Major League Baseball owners could lock out their players as soon as tonight. If players and owners don't work out a deal, we could see the first work stoppage in baseball in 26 years. Let's check on the situation and some other sports news with Barry Svrluga, sports columnist at The Washington Post. Hey, Barry.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well, and I want to start with this looming lockout. The dispute is mainly about money, of course, but spell out the issues for us.
Well, it is about money, and it's about how much money the players get in the share of revenue that, despite a lot of lamenting of baseball standing in the national sports landscape, revenues for Major League Baseball continue to rise. So essentially, players are saying, look, if you're making more money, we should be making a higher percentage of that. They cite stats that show that the average salary for a Major League Baseball player has fallen each year since 2017. And more than that, they lament kind of a strategy in the sport in which teams intentionally suffer through bad seasons and are not competitive in order to get high draft picks and get younger, cheaper labor that allows them to rise and be contenders. They would like a system that rewards spending, rewards being competitive annually, and rewards 30 teams trying to win a championship rather than half the sport trying and half the sport not.
Yeah, I know fans often grumble about that tanking method that we see across other sports. Sometimes it works. Look at the Philadelphia 76ers, but it is painful in the process. What other rule changes do the players want here?
We're likely to see the designated hitter finally come to the National League. The two leagues have been playing under a different set of rules. The pitchers hitting in one league and a designated hitter hitting in the other league for, you know, 40 years. But I think the sport has other issues. It is dealing with a set of circumstances that has made it slow and in some cases, even for a purist like myself, rather boring. I would like to see both sides put aside the financial dispute and say, look, in the interest of our sport going forward, we've got to restore the balance between pitching and hitting that has made this such a beautiful game for so long.
I think what you're hitting on here, Barry, though, really underscores the high stakes here, right? Because as those balls in play have gone down, the pace of play has slowed down. Some fans are losing interest, and if there's a prolonged lockout, that could really drive even more fans away. So what are the stakes?
Oh, they're extraordinarily high. And I don't think that fans are going to be bitter about a lockout that lasts from December 2nd until January 5th. If it starts pushing back spring training and opening day gets moved back and the season is shortened and there are tangible consequences to a dispute that most people will see as between billionaires and millionaires, then you're daring your fan base to hang with you through that. And I don't think the sport nationally is in position to dare their fan base to, look for an off-ramp and choose another sport at a time when the on-field issues already give them enough excuses to do that.
Sure. We are at least several months away from losing actual games. But Barry, I want to get to another story about players and money. Some players who are actually already active. I'm thinking about this news this week that Gatorade has signed its first ever endorsement deal with a college athlete. Remember, they're allowed to profit from their name, image, and likeness now. And the new sports drink spokesperson is going to be UConn sophomore Paige Beckers. She's the top player in the women's game. Barry, the best men's basketball players often leave college after just one season, but the women generally play all 4 years. I'm wondering if you think this could be the start of a trend in which sponsors gravitate to female athletes who are going to become more familiar to fans because they stay in school longer.
Absolutely. And I think it's a perfect entry point for a national entity like Gatorade. And frankly, a national entity like UConn basketball and whoever, UConn women's basketball and whoever happens to be the star at that school at that time. This has been a long time coming. You're right in that I think there's more appeal and more lasting appeal for an athlete that is going to be around for 4 years, or in this case, 3 more years. She's going to become a brand name for UConn basketball. This allows her to become a brand name for herself and make some money off the image that she's generated. That's hard work that puts her in this position. She should be able to profit off of it, and she is.
And we're seeing some of her teammates already signing other deals as well. Barry, before you go, somebody who certainly has signed his share of endorsement deals over the years is Tiger Woods. He made some, I think, pretty somber news yesterday. He had his first news conference since he was badly injured in that car crash in February. And he said he almost lost his leg. It almost had to be amputated. And he's not sure he'll ever be able to play competitive golf again, certainly not a full-time schedule. What does that mean for the game? I mean, it sounds like the end of an era.
Well, it sounded like the end of an era for a while for Tiger, too. And, he's one of those figures who almost dares you to write him off. And it almost is kind of supplying the material for his own athletic obituary here. He is 45, so there's a limit to how long he could be consistently competitive. If Tiger Woods is healthy again, he won't be able to play 30 tournaments a year. But I don't put it past him to find lightning in a bottle one time and at Augusta National or someplace that he's really familiar with, contend in a major.
Interesting. We did see Jack Nicklaus win the Masters at 46, so maybe Tiger can one-up him. That's Barry Sferluga, sports columnist for The Washington Post. Barry, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.